Blog Talk Radio.
You got to listen to the Bob Carson Show. It's about the real deal. And this is Les Leopold, the author of Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I've the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009, when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
Hi, this is Harry Kaysen, member supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on. Not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
This is Greg Palin, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book, Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. And you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio. Radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
Listeners, and welcome to Carson's Corner with the Election Boycott Advocates. This is your co-host, Chris Driscoll. And unfortunately, Bob will not be joining us tonight. Bob Carson, our show founder, he got called in last moment into work. However, we do have Rainer Shea with us. Hello, Rainer. How are you?
Hello. Things are looking relatively up for me, though they're getting worse for the rest of the world. Because I'm seeing the development of class consciousness and the continued shifting of geopolitical trends towards a post unipolar world. We've been in a multipolar world for a while, and U.S. imperialism is declining.
I agree with you 100%. We've been talking about that on the show for several years now, actually. But yes, we're starting to really see the signs more and more prominently for that. And Rainer, you're going to be talking about some aspects of that right up top here in our first topic for the night. Of course, the show, this episode, is running with the theme of American Empire ramps up war moves under cover of COVID-19 pandemic. But topic number one, what to expect from the American Empire in its decline, in its death agony period. You've written a really stupendous, I thought, a stupendous article covering different aspects of the impact of the COVID virus on the American Empire, on American imperialism, and how American imperialism is using this worldwide pandemic as a cover, really, to ramp up its hybrid asymmetrical warfare against several countries. So why don't you go ahead and launch into this idea of the American Empire and its decline, what we can expect during this period, as you're calling it, post-multipolar period.
Yeah, post-unipolar. I'm sorry. Yesterday I watched a video from the Empire Files explaining how Washington has been exploiting the virus to further its economic warfare against numerous nations, against all of the nations that it's sanctioning, and to escalate its bombing campaigns in countries like Iraq, and these nations that are whose people are suffering increasingly as a result of both this virus and as a result of U.S. sanctions and direct warfare. These nations include Yemen, Iran, Venezuela, Iraq, Syria, and all throughout. I'm noticing the rhetorical tools that the Trump White House is utilizing in order to justify its actions and to mask the fact that it's hurting humanitarian efforts worldwide with its widespread and illegal acts of warfare. This language that spokespeople like Mike Pompeo use consists of increasingly demonizing and hyperbolizing the designated enemies. I don't know exactly which official said this, but when the Trump administration increased sanctions on Iran last month, a White House official claimed that Iran is a Marxist kleptocracy, and that's why it needs to be punished, even though these sanctions are only hurting the Iranian people. The Trump White House and the broader American political and media establishment are also using the crisis to demonize China, to paint the Communist Party of China as the one to blame for this outbreak, in addition to all the other ways that China is vilified as a threat and as an oppressive force. There's also the recent campaign to manufacture consent for a regime change effort in Venezuela, where the Trump White House has fabricated outlandish crimes supposedly committed by Maduro's government that supposedly pertain to so-called narco-terrorism and proliferating cocaine. And so they've used that as a pretext for sending Navy ships to Venezuela and for getting Colombia and Brazil to send military aid for the potential invasion effort. So we're seeing all of this belligerence and this hyperbolic rhetoric. And when I read Umberto Eco's 1995 essay "War Fascism," I immediately thought of the current state of American foreign policy, because in that essay, Umberto Eco articulates how fascists view war. Fascists see their political mission as an eternal war against nebulous enemies. And famously, Eco wrote that by a constant rhetorical shift, fascists portray their enemies as simultaneously too weak and too strong. This is the case for U.S. rhetoric against its enemies. Simultaneously, countries like China are portrayed as a vast, powerful force that has the potential to greatly impact American life, and yet Washington acts like China and Iran and these other countries are weak enough for Washington to be able to massively aggress against them without any consequence. So there's a dissonance, a contradiction there, that's inevitably leading to what Umberto Eco also pointed out about the nature of how fascists wage war. He pointed out how fascist governments are doomed to lose wars because they're constitutionally incapable of estimating the real capability of their enemies. Now the United States is running into this problem as the reality, for one thing, is that it's not really capable of invading Iran, even though it's been carrying out anti-Iran war games in the last month, and I don't think it really has the potential to invade Venezuela without causing vast damage to its own military apparatus. Would you agree that a Venezuelan invasion won't happen because it would be too costly of an option?
Well, I think it would be a disaster for the American empire to attempt that. I won't predict that it won't. Matter of fact, in topic two, we'll be talking more in depth about that, about the American empire's hybrid asymmetrical war on the Venezuelan people, and it really is. It's getting a lot of people that I'm in touch with in the United States who are part of the U.S. anti-war movement very worried, and they think that the anti-war movement really needs to mobilize right now around this, and there's been discussion about how the lockdown, the nationwide voluntary lockdown, because it's still voluntary in most parts of the country, is affecting the ability of people to protest this. So, you know, on the one hand, I agree with you. It would be insane for Trump to invade Venezuela, but unfortunately, you know, he's doing all the things that you expect a belligerent imperial power to do when moving towards a war buildup. And most of history has shown, war buildups almost always inevitably lead to war. Not always, but just about always. So, you know, I won't write it off, the idea that that the Trump regime could invade Venezuela. I kind of think that they will probably use proxies to harass Venezuela along its borders, to spread widespread economic sabotage, which they've already done in the last year, to continue that effort and ramp up that effort. We'll see how it goes, Rainer, but, you know, it would certainly, I think it would be the nail in the coffin of the American empire if the American empire were to invade either Venezuela or Iran, two countries that are armed with sophisticated defense weapons, two countries that are that have large militaries, two countries that are totally prepared to meet and beat back any imperialist sneak attack or invasion. So we'll see. I guess we can hope for the best, you know.
Uh-huh. Washington's current regime change plan is to continue the sanctions against Venezuela's people amid the pandemic, and also apparently to threaten Venezuela's borders with an array of military weapons until the country's socialist leadership agrees to step down and be surpassed by the National Assembly, which Washington has more control of.
I think that's what is most likely and what we can expect. So, you mentioned Umberto Eco. He's one of my favorite novelists. For instance, I read that novel that he wrote that was a worldwide bestseller, In the Name of the Rose. And then there was a movie made of it with Sean Connery playing the lead role in that. And who was the other one? I can't remember this guy's name. I'll remember it later on. Maybe I'll look it up here next time you talk. But it was a stupendous movie. He was one of the best novelists in the world, literary giant, and as you point out, a political essayist of some great renown as well. But yeah, we are definitely looking at moving into a period where the decline of the American empire, we can expect because of that, for the United States, for the American empire to continually lash out in irrational ways, which is what empires in their decline usually do. They're really much like, I think in a discussion we had on one of your posts on Facebook, I pointed out that this is much like a wounded tiger, you know, that it looks like it's dying, it's slowly bleeding out, but it can still do a lot of damage because it will lash out in irrational ways during this during its death agony, as I call it. So yeah, we can definitely we are seeing the signs of that, and we can expect more of it. So on to topic number two, which is the American Empire ramps up its hybrid asymmetrical war on the Venezuelan people. We've already had a little bit of discussion about this. One thing that's very worrying, we reported, I guess it was either last week, I think it was last week, about this, the absurd charges by the American Justice Department or Miss Justice Department, charges that the president of Venezuela, president and vice president and several other high officials, the charge that they are involved in narco-terrorism, as the Americans were calling it, of course, is totally absurd. All of the statistics show that that Venezuela is not the source of the drug problem. It is not in any way, its government is not facilitating drug movement to the United States, but that's the charge. I mean, in fact, the statistics show that only 7% of drugs bound for the United States from South America move through any part of Venezuela. And most of that is on Venezuela's eastern border with Colombia. And, of course, we know Colombia is the real source, the real problem. And we know that the United States, in fact, facilitates this massive drug operation by Colombia. Colombia is, of course, America's leading ally in that region. And that is the real source of the massive drugs coming into the United States. That's what the statistics show. But these, you know, facts don't matter to Donald Trump, obviously. In any case, this week, after that, the American so-called Department of Defense has been moving military, naval ships, military personnel, naval ships into the Caribbean, threatening Venezuela, and military personnel to Colombia, also threatening Venezuela. So it is really engaged right now in a buildup against Venezuela. This is on top of the economic sabotage that the American Empire has been waging against Venezuela over the last year. For instance, the attacks on Venezuela's electrical grid, which caused the blackout of 70-80% of the country at one point, and it caused rolling blackouts, several rolling blackouts in Venezuela, as though Venezuela can, Venezuela is already experiencing difficulties because of America's economic war on that country. Sanctions, they call it sanctions, but in fact, these are not real sanctions. Sanctions are not economic war moves that are carried out by one criminal rogue nation like the United States. Or legitimate sanctions can only come from the United Nations. And the United Nations has not declared any sanctions on Venezuela. So these are not sanctions. These are highly criminal, highly provocative acts of war by the American Empire against the Venezuelan people. So as I mentioned earlier, the anti-war movement in the United States is calling on people to protest this, to be creative about figuring out ways that we can protest this during this nationwide lockdown, during this period when protests will undoubtedly be actual street demonstrations will undoubtedly be crushed by the military and the police if they happen. So we really need to be creative and come up with new ways of expressing our displeasure at our own criminal government, which is carrying out this this war crime against the Venezuelan people.
Yeah. I feel like we covered a lot of it so far, in that the U.S. Empire is lashing out increasingly, and what we could focus on is that despite all of this, the Bolivarian Revolution and the Chavista movement are well prepared for this. They're able to withstand all of these attacks because all of their coups have failed so far. Chavez and his successor Maduro have remained in control of the military, and that's let them withstand all of the coups so far. So I doubt any future coup will actually work. And plus, they have over 3 million people in their movement, armed and trained, ready to defend from a potential invasion. And as Maduro said in an interview last year, the imperialists are going to continue to fail in their efforts to unseat this movement, and their movement is going to continue to make inroads via electoral politics and continuing the efforts to improve people's living conditions. Though obviously it's been a very arduous march for the Venezuelan people experiencing these sanctions. Tens of thousands have died because of Washington's actions blocking resources from coming to their. And now, amid this pandemic, it's getting worse. This is a dark time for them. Therefore, who knows how long this pandemic will last? And now, obviously, throughout this whole time, Washington is going to keep waging this economic war against all these innocent bystanders.
Yes, definitely. And as you point out, Venezuela is prepared, and we should know that. Venezuela back when the late great Hugo Chavez was still alive. Venezuela prepared itself really well by creating a citizens' militia of millions of people. I think right now they say they have something like 2.2 million citizens trained and armed. And that, along with their standing military apparatus, Army, Navy, and so forth, of more than half a million, that is a military force that the American Empire would have a really difficult time going up against. I can remember, actually, a CIA report. I think it was either 1963 or 1964, about Cuba. And, of course, we know the United States, under the Kennedy regime, was viciously opposed to the Cuban people and the Castro government at that time. They used all kinds of they used biological warfare, as we've mentioned in the last couple of weeks, against Cuba, trying to inflict all kinds of diseases on the Cuban people and on their crops, on their livestock, and so forth. There were dozens and dozens of CIA attempts attempting to murder Fidel Castro, all of which were thankfully not successful. That is what we can expect. That is the kind of thing that the American Empire does when a people express the will to go in a socialist direction, to build towards socialism. And at this at that time, early on in the Cuban Revolution in the early to mid 60s, the CIA did a report that they showed President Kennedy that told him that basically because Cuba had pretty much every adult at that time, every adult citizen armed and trained into citizen militias, they were saying that it would take well over 1.5 million standing army to invade and take over Cuba. And of course, at that time, America couldn't afford a standing army just to commit to this one war, especially not when it was already in Vietnam. We can understand, I think, that an invasion of Venezuela would require a massive U.S. military buildup, a massive probably require, I would imagine, I wouldn't even say probably, I would say most definitely, would require a draft that would be highly unpopular in the United States now. So, it would be extremely costly for the American government to invade Venezuela. I don't expect it, but on the other hand, as we know from the inept, buffoonish, and often insane Donald Trump, we often get the unexpected. So we'll see. So anything on Venezuela?
Oh, well, you brought up Cuba, and I'm seeing parallels to that great triumph that Castro's revolution carried out. The Bay of Pigs invasion of 1961 failed, and the next year Castro showed how serious he and his movement were about self-determination by taking it to the next level. Castro called upon the USSR to assist Cuba in gaining a nuclear deterrent, and that resulted in the Cuban Missile Crisis, or rather the Cuban Missile Greatness. They were willing to use nuclear weapons to fend off the imperialists. And I call it
the Turkish missile crisis, since it was actually the American Empire putting nuclear missiles in Turkey, just miles from the Soviet border, that really precipitated this crisis. It's a misnomer to call it the Cuban Missile Crisis. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, the Cuban Missile Greatness. That's one way to look at it, and now we see a potential parallel of that, since Venezuela has allies with Russia and China.
Yeah, definitely. And the American governments since 2002 have been protesting the fact that both Russia and China have been selling advanced weapon systems to Venezuela for its protection, for its defense. The Americans really don't like that, because the Americans are used to picking on countries that are not able to stand up against the big bully on the block. That's been, you know, a primary feature of the American imperialism has been the targets that the American Empire chooses to attack. They are always weak targets, low-hanging fruit, easy targets. Iran and Venezuela are not easy targets. They are not a cakewalk. Okay, moving on to topic number three, the U.S. disinformation campaign against China. This is also something that you wrote about, Rainer, in the last week, I'm hoping that you can shed more light on this. There's also a great article in the Gray Zone called U.S. Pushes Conspiracy Theory on China's Coronavirus Death Toll to Deflect from Trump Administration Failures. So, Rainer, why don't you start us off here with some background, talk about what you wrote in your article on this subject, and maybe a little bit about, in general, what's going on there.
Since the start of this virus, when it started proliferating throughout China, Western media has made an effort to portray its handling of this crisis as incompetent and or authoritarian. One narrative has been that they've silenced a COVID-19 whistleblower named Li Wenliang. Yet, the day after Li Wenliang went public with his information about the virus, the Chinese government also decided that it was time to make it public. So his decision to reveal it wasn't in opposition to what China thought. Plus, China didn't go after him for revealing that information. What they did What they did target him for was when he mistakenly spread a piece of false information on WeChat, which the Chinese authorities issued a warning to him about. However, since his death, the Chinese government has retracted its warning to him and honored him as one of the heroic doctors of this crisis. So that was a ridiculous way that Western media has distorted these developments and painted China as covering up the crisis. They said that China waited too long to take action, and then they said that China's response to it was oppressive towards China's people. This is coming from the Vice article that I quote in my article. This Vice article that characterizes China's quarantine as a repressive lockdown. So all of this I feel is to be expected, since the Western media is really determined to spin anything China does in a negative light. And now we're seeing the intelligence agencies manufacturing something akin to the WMD claim, the Iraq WMD claim, in that a few anonymous intel officials have been quoted in this Bloomberg article, and they haven't shown the reporters any evidence behind their claims, but they're putting it out there that they believe China covered this up. Who knows if they actually believe it, because the job of U.S. intelligence agencies is to lie to you.
Okay, just wanted to make sure you were finished there, Rainer. Also the article in Gray Zone, which I think was really quite good. TheGrayZone.com. We've discussed numerous times in the past. And in that article by Ajit Singh, as I said before, the title of the article is U.S. Pushes Conspiracy Theory on China's Coronavirus Death Toll to Deflect from the Trump Administration Failures. And in this article, Ajit Singh goes into several ways that the American empire and its totally housebroken media and a few of its allies, such as the UK, the United Kingdom, have been basically spreading lies about China's effort to fight the pandemic. They claim, for instance, that while China's official statistics for deaths from the virus so far were a bit more than 3,000, and that's pretty damn good for a nation of almost 1.4 billion people. They are claiming that the death toll was closer to 100,000 people, and that China is covering this up as the proof that they're putting forward, if you could call it proof. They cited a shipment of urns in March to to Wuhan of 5,000 urns, and yet the total death rate in Wuhan at that time had been a little more than 2,000. Of course, they failed to mention that in Wuhan, typically in a typical month, more than 5,000 people die, you know, just from the normal. Wuhan is a city of 11 million people. So, I mean, they have just a normal average death rate during those periods of time, during any normal period of time, where close to 5,000 people die each month. So, of course, they're going to need, you know, 5,000 urns, especially when they're also dealing with a pandemic at the same time. It does not at all, of course. I mean, any reasonable person who can count would not take that as indicating that the real national death toll in China was 100,000 people. It just wasn't. The American Empire, the British Empire, along with some of their allies in, like Taiwan, for instance, are pushing, have pushed, for instance, through Radio Free Asia, which is a CIA creation, are pushing this idea that this outbreak in China was as the result of a leak from laboratories. Once again, without giving any kind of evidence or proof behind that. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization has been saying consistently over this past period that the that China's response to the coronavirus outbreak was a model response that the whole world should learn from. And also officials from the World Health Organization are saying that, you know, the American charges that there's some kind of a conspiracy to cover up tens of thousands of deaths from the virus in China is just a plain out-and-out lie. So, also recommended to people is to check out thegrayzone.com for that information.
You mentioned the World Health Organization. Oh, you still talking?
Yep,
okay.
Go ahead.
Well, you mentioned the World Health Organization, and I've noticed a very bizarre cartoon, a very bizarre piece of imperialist propaganda, I think proliferated by Radio Free Asia as well, by a propaganda cartoonist called Rebel Pepper, and the cartoon I'm looking at now has a picture of the World Health Organization's logo with a menacing dragon intertwined with it, and it's captioned, "World Health Organization, controlled by China." So that's what Radio Free Asia is trying to proliferate, the kinds of ideas they're trying to instill in people's heads. I mean, I haven't seen any headlines even in the American media about the World Health Organization being controlled by China, but this is the kind of stuff that Radio Free Asia has pushed for decades, especially in times of turmoil like this during the 1989 Tiananmen Square protests. Radio Free Asia strategically promoted outlandish disinformation targeted towards the population that they were trying to rile up. Like, I think it was one of the claims they made was like a top official had been shot or something like that. I could recommend an article about that. But anyway, Radio Free Asia, they know what they're doing. They're trying to influence perceptions in certain regions. They're pushing psychological operations, telling people that the World Health Organization is controlled by China. So that's one of the things that they want people to believe.
Yeah. So that goes on. Rainer, you mentioned early on that countries are starting to respond to the American attacks on countries around the world, and you posted an article today from Consortium News. That was published today, Monday, April 6th, titled COVID-19, Some 90 Nations, Some 70 Nations Now Back Call for Global Ceasefire. And this is an interesting development. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has been leading this effort to get nations around the world to sign on to a global ceasefire. So far, the United States and Great Britain have not signed on, but many nations have signed on. And this is, I think, a really good counter, at least as far as propaganda and as far as popular opinion around the world. This is a great effort being led by Antonio Guterres move a peace message. Not only have nations signed onto this, more than 70 nations, but non-state actors, civil society networks and organizations, religious leaders, including Pope Francis, have added their moral voice in support of a global ceasefire, as have citizens through grassroots mobilization online. Some nations that are in conflict have signed on to this call, including Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Libya, Myanmar, South Sudan, Sudan, Syria, Ukraine, and Yemen have all signed on to this call. So, this great, I think, a great effort, something that we should keep our eyes on and applaud whenever we get a chance. Definitely sign on to endorse. So what are your thoughts, Rainer?
I hope that when the list is released, we see some of America's allies and non-aligned nations are participating in this sign on to a call for peace. I feel like this is really in response to the United States with its perpetually escalating warfare campaigns against all of these populations. they've bombed Iraq, and they've pushed themselves closer to war with Iran, and they've launched aggressions in the South China Sea, and also in Syria. It's become apparent to so many that these belligerent imperialist powers are exacerbating the humanitarian crises at the worst possible time, but obviously the United States and these other belligerent nations aren't going to adhere to this, but it's certainly making a lot of nations see just how bad of an ally or a potential ally the United States is. You know, China is the one that's pushing for peace. The U.S. is pushing for ever more war and for increased humanitarian disasters, all for the purpose of its geopolitical interests.
Yes, absolutely. And this is, what we would predict, what we would expect. More and more, hopefully, Americans will break through the wall of disinformation that we are blasted with, inundated with every day from billionaire-owned news media, to look at the truth and see the evidence is there of who are the warmongers, who are moving towards war, and who are moving towards peace. So who are opposed to imperialist wars. So that hopefully more and more people will start to see this. I've lived through times when that happened, like during the Vietnam War. The Americans more and more started seeing that it was our own country that was the criminal, and that the Vietnamese people were simply fighting for their own freedom from imperialist domination. The Americans were the invaders. They were the bad guys. We can see that in every war that the United States has been involved in since then as well, that the Americans are always the invaders. They're always the ones invading other nations, and then other nations do what you would expect other nations to do, that is, they start fighting back. At least the majority of people in those nations start fighting back. So in the next, actually, three topics, I think actually we could combine this into one topic, come to think of it, because they're all about the economic responses of various countries. And the examples I'm using are Russia, Mexico, and Spain, versus the American economic response to the COVID-19 pandemic crisis. Russia, as a first example, President Putin is crafting his response to the to this COVID-19 epidemic, which is getting worse in Russia. It's nowhere near as bad as it is in the United States, which has more cases than any other country. More, but it is getting worse in Russia right now. And the one thing that President Putin said right off the bat was that the rich are going to have to pay for this for the economic fallout from the COVID-19 virus, which is, I think, exactly what any rational leader would be saying. He's letting the rich know that their big companies will not be bailed out, letting them know that he is going to favor a stimulus package that is aimed at the working class Russians, not at the ruling capitalist class Russians, and that they're going to have to pay for a change, which is what they should be doing. In the case of the United States, of course, the exact opposite. The American economic response has been to spend literally trillions of dollars bailing out the big banks once again, just like in 2008, bailing out the big banks and the big multinational capitalist concerns. Small business and the working class gets short shrift in this. I mean, there are several countries that are giving payments to their citizens for the entire time during this crisis monthly, whereas in the United States, people are getting a one-time dole out of $1,200, which for most people doesn't even pay the rent over 1 month, and they certainly can't live on it for more than 1 month. So the economic response is definitely a capitalist response, and the kind of response we always see in a capitalist system. We'll talk in just a few minutes about Mexico and Spain, two other examples of the same thing. Actually, let's just go ahead and mention that Mexico, the President Obrador, is often called, he's a social democrat, he's often called a populist, he has said in no uncertain terms that he will not be bailing out big corporations and banks, and that his stimulus package will be aimed at poor and working class people, people on Main Street, not on Wall Street, so to speak, the way we might put it in the United States. But Mexico, the same thing. And finally, Spain. It was announced last night that Spain will be introducing a universal basic income. The details aren't all worked out yet. It was just announced yesterday, but the economic minister who announced this said that she expects this to become a permanent thing after the virus is over. So it looks like the Spanish government is actually looking towards introducing a universal basic income, a monthly payment to every person in Spain. So those are examples of what other countries are doing to help out their working people during this crisis, and what the United States is not doing to help out working people, and what it is doing to help out the billionaires, the capitalist ruling class.
I've been studying this stuff as well. I've been studying how just how bad it is for the American economy in particular, and just how dire of a situation we can expect. I'm going to quote an article called "America is Committing Economic Suicide," written by Umair Hakay. It says, "Coronavirus is an extinction-level event for modern economies. That is why all this, my friends, is an event the likes of which the modern world has never really seen before, not even in war, natural calamity, or financial crisis, because when a society reaches even about 25% or so of sudden, irreversible, long-term, hardcore unemployment, the economy is more or less finished. It can never recover for generations. That means that huge numbers of businesses are shuttered, jobs are destroyed, never to come back, incomes vanished, savings gone, homes foreclosed on. It is the end of families, relationships, stability, hope. It is usually the end of democracy, too, as people turn to strongmen in their rage and discontent and despair. Economic ruin is the end of a gentle, modern, wise culture, society, and politics in this way. The root of all ruin. All that collapse is now very much in America's near future. Not next year, but this summer, because the response to coronavirus has been profoundly inadequate. You can see it in everyday life. A doctor is fashioning masks from pizza boxes, the dying sharing ventilators. All this reflects the simple fact. The American government didn't do nearly enough about the greatest economic shock in modern history. It barely did anything at all.
Yes, I did read that article when you sent it out. It was a very good response, and I agree. That is what we are looking at, what we're looking on, what we have to look forward to, unless we start to organize and respond to it. And that's what we really need to do in this country. The reason that the presidents of Mexico and Russia and the prime minister of Spain are issuing a more reasonable response than the anti-working class American response is that they listen to their people. They know to be afraid of their people. They know what can happen when they don't listen to their people. You know, in the last century, Russia, Mexico, and Spain have gone through revolutions, have gone through revolutionary upheavals, and they know what happens when you don't listen to the people. America's revolution is more than, 240 years now, something like that. And unfortunately, the ruling class in America has forgotten what it means to really elicit the anger of the masses of people, and they'd better start learning that lesson, and we had better start figuring out how to organize ourselves. It's not that hard to figure it out, you know. In my opinion, read Marx and Engels and Lenin and a few other communist leaders over the last 200 years, and they tell you everything you need to know about how to organize yourselves, ourselves, as a cohesive power to fight back against what is really a war. The American capitalist ruling class is waging a war on us, on the working class here at home, and everywhere in the world. We need to get together with the entire working class around the world and start organizing to fight back, organizing to take power, ultimately, so that we don't have to go through this. There's no reason for the kind of mess that we're facing in the United States today. There's no reason for this other than that we have allowed billionaires to run our country in their interests, not in our interests. So, anything else tonight, Rainer?
No, well, I kind of want to reiterate an action plan for our current situation that I've iterated in the past. Well, what we can do in the immediate months is participate in the general strikes, spread class consciousness on social media, and recruit for parties like the Party for Socialism and Liberation, the World Workers Party, what are other parties, good parties, can you think of?
Well, let me see. I think those are two good examples that you mentioned. I know people in both of those political organizations. I've known Brian Becker, for instance, for more than 20 years. Worked with him. He actually, when I lived in Tacoma Park, Maryland, he just lived a few blocks from me. And we used to have lunch together, Brian and I and several other friends. On Sundays, we'd go to the local Indian buffet and chow down and have great political discussions. So, and Brian, of course, is one of the founders. I would say the key founder, but I don't know if he likes to, you know, be pointed out like that. But one of the founders of the PSL. You know, as I said, I've had really good friends that are in the WWP as well, the Workers' World Party. Those are two organizations that I think are typically have a great response to U.S. imperial policy. Which is really worth following. I don't agree with them or any other party 100%, but when do you ever find 100% agreement? Right, Rainer?
Yeah. Now,
difference is the spice of life.
Now,
so,
as we...
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you.
As we build these institutions for revolt, we need to carry on the project to escalate the actions that we'll take and that we're capable of taking as a class to fight back in this class war that the ruling class is waging against us. Right now, our main means for class struggle are the strikes. And
yeah,
after the virus risks go down, hopefully we'll need to make it so that that the United States has a mass protest movement similar to the ones in Chile and France.
Absolutely.
Hopefully these protests will continue and be able to sustain themselves in the face of state repression, and that's where strong institutions for revolt come in. Institutions can help mass movements overcome repression. And if we do this, if we keep this movement going, then after the main means for class struggle is strikes, and then after the main means becomes mass public civil disobedience, our main tool could become storming the enclaves of the wealthy and taking over governmental centers. This is what India's Naxalite Maoists have been doing, taking over local governments and gaining territory from India's fascist government, which is undoubtedly what we'll be facing in the coming decade.
Yes, couldn't say it better myself, Rainer. That's exactly the route we need to take, the route we need to point towards. The issue of organizing ourselves politically, I think there's a lot more that can be said and should be said about that. And we'll be having discussions. We should have discussions in the coming shows about that. So with that, Rainer, I want to thank everyone in the listening audience for listening in, whether you're listening to our live broadcast here on Blog Talk Radio, or whether you're listening to our recorded podcast, which you can get in perpetuity, hopefully, and listen to it anytime at your convenience. If you're interested more in what we're all about, you can look us up on Facebook, do a Facebook search in the little search box that they have up in the far in the top left part of Facebook. Do a search for Election Boycott Advocates. You can find us there and join our Facebook page if you like. You can also find us Rainer's prolific writing, especially prolific in the last couple of weeks, at RainerShea.com. Or on the Dandelion Salad website. That's another great place to go for Rainer's articles. And Rainer, thank you so much for your stupendous contributions tonight. Couldn't have done it, literally, couldn't have done it without you. And that's it for us until next Monday. Same time, same channel on Blog Talk Radio.
Yep.
Yeah, so long, Rainer.
Bye.
Hasta la vista until next week.
Okay.